Imagine a single plant root, right? A root that can literally turn off the absolute agony of opioid withdrawal and do it in just 24 hours.
Yeah, which is completely wild when you think about
it. Right. A botanical switch that just completely bypasses the bone-deep sickness. It mutes the psychological cravings that, you know, constantly drive relapse. It essentially does what the entirety of modern multi-billion dollar Western medicine has completely failed to achieve.
Exactly. It's almost unbelievable.
But then imagine that this exact same molecule carries a very real, heavily documented risk of disrupting the electrical rhythm of your heart so severely that it just kills you.
I mean, it is the ultimate pharmacological paradox.
Yeah.
You are looking at a substance that offers this unprecedented biological reset for arguably one of the most intractable conditions in medicine. But it's resting right alongside genuine lethal danger.
It's terrifying, fascinating.
Right. It challenges our fundamental assumptions about risk, about reward, and honestly, about what is even medically possible.
And that paradox is exactly what we are unpacking today for you, the listener. We're doing a deep dive into this remarkably comprehensive July 28th, 2026 article from the OTW Journal. It's titled Ibogaine and Addiction Interruption: The Neuroscience of the Reset.
It's such a brilliant piece of literature.
It really is. So whether you are fascinated by like the bleeding edge of neuroscience, or you're tracking the future of mental health treatments, or you're just looking for an aha moment about how the human brain's reward system actually functions, this deep dive is going to deliver.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this is not just a story about a controversial drug. This is a story about the fundamental wiring of human desire, the architecture of suffering, really, and the desperate lengths science is going to in order to hack it. Yeah. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the foundational history of the molecule.
We do. Because long before we had functional MRI machines or, you know, clinical trials mapping neurochemistry, there was the root itself.
Right.
Specifically, Tabernanthia iboga. It's a perennial rainforest shrub native to Central Africa, primarily found in Gabon.
And the active compound is nestled in the bark, right?
Yeah, the principal psychoactive alkaloid found within the yellowish inner root bark of that shrub is ibogaine. And context is really everything here.
Totally.
Because for centuries, this wasn't viewed through the lens of pathology or medical treatment at all. It has been this central, revered pillar of the Bodhi spiritual tradition.
Which the article goes into, and it's just fascinating.
It is. The way indigenous practitioners utilize this plant demonstrates this masterful understanding of dose-dependent pharmacology.
Yeah.
Something Western medicine often takes decades to map out.
Yeah, the source material breaks down that dose dependency, and it highlights two completely different functional uses depending on how much you take.
Right.
Like in very small subperceptual doses, the Bulidi used the root bark as a highly effective hunting stimulant.
Which makes sense chemically.
Yeah, it heightens visual and auditory acuity, it drastically reduces the need for sleep, and it just wards off the profound fatigue of navigating a really dense, unforgiving forest environment.
It acts as an elite survival tool in that low-dose context.
Survival tool, exactly.
The pharmacological mechanism there is likely related to its stimulant properties, subtly engaging the central nervous system without tipping over into the profound altered states.
Right. They aren't hallucinating while hunting.
Exactly.
Huh.
But the cultural reverence, like the real architectural weight of the Bodhi tradition, revolves around the massive ceremonial doses.
But high-dose rituals.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In those high quantities, the root becomes a powerful onerogen.
A dream generator.
Right, a dream generator. They use it for these vital rites of passage. It produces a days-long visionary state meant to initiate members into adulthood, process communal grief, and within their cosmological framework, commune directly with their ancestors.
Wow. It's a deeply integrated sacrament. The ritual provides the container for the psychological intensity of the chemical.
Exactly.
But then you contrast that pristine, culturally embedded framework with how Western medicine stumbled upon it, which is just wild. We land in 1962, completely devoid of ritual.
Right in the middle of the American counterculture.
Exactly. And we have this 19-year-old named Howard Lotsoff.
Lotsoff's encounter with ibogaine is, I mean, it's one of the most consequential accidents in the history of pharmacology.
Totally.
In 1962, he was living in New York, and he was heavily dependent on heroin.
Right.
He was also part of that early psychedelic vanguard, constantly seeking out and experimenting with novel compounds. And a chemist friend just gave him a dose of ibogaine.
And to be completely clear here, Lotsoff was not looking for a medical breakthrough.
No, not at all.
He wasn't seeking a cure for his heroin dependency. He was literally just looking for a new high, a new Saturday night experience. So he ingested it, endured what we now know as this grueling marathon-length hallucinogenic experience, and eventually just went to sleep.
Yeah. And when he woke up, the trajectory of addiction medicine permanently shifted, even if it took the establishment decades to realize it.
What actually happened when he woke up?
Lotsoff woke up and realized he simply wasn't experiencing opioid withdrawal.
None of the sickness.
None of it. Furthermore, he realized he didn't even have the desire to seek out heroin. The biological imperative that had been dictating his every waking action was completely silent.
This is where I find the historical narrative so compelling. Think about the sheer statistical improbability of this.
That's staggering.
It's akin to someone trying to invent a new flavor of chewing gum in their garage and accidentally synthesizing a compound that cures a systemic autoimmune disease.
That's a great way to put it.
I mean, we know many of our critical drugs come from plants, like aspirin from willow bark or quinine from the cinchona tree, but those were usually identified because indigenous people were already using them for those specific medical purposes.
Right.
The Bawidi weren't using ibogaine to cure heroin addiction. Lotsoff just stumbled into a biochemical backdoor. Does this happen often in pharmacology, or is this the luckiest accident in addiction medicine?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a profound anomaly, particularly because of the complexity of the disease it interrupted. Usually, serendipitous discoveries in medicine, like, you know, Alexander Fleming noticing mold-killing bacteria in a petri dish leading to penicillin, they happen within a laboratory setting where someone is primed to recognize the therapeutic mechanism.
Lotsoff was just a teenager in the counterculture.
Exactly. Yet he immediately recognized the gravity of what had happened to his brain. He didn't just walk away and forget about it.
No, he became an evangelist for it.
He spent the remainder of his life trying to force a highly skeptical medical establishment and the FDA to pay attention to this route. He essentially birthed an entire underground movement where desperate people began passing this substance across international borders.
And that desperation from the underground community makes absolute sense when you strip away the stigma and look at the neurological reality of what opioid dependence actually is.
It really does.
The transition from Lotsoff's lucky accident in the 60s to the biological reality of what this molecule does to a brain in crisis brings us to a core concept in the source material, the addiction interruption phenomenon.
Yeah, the specific terminology used in the journal interruption is vital here.
Why that word specifically?
Because it draws a stark line between the mechanism of ibogaine and the standard Western protocols for treating severe opioid use disorder. Modern medicine relies heavily on substitution therapy, utilizing molecules like methadone or buprenorphine.
Which, to be fair, are undeniably life-saving. We have to acknowledge that medication-assisted treatment keeps people from dying of overdoses and stabilizes their lives.
Oh, without question. Harm reduction is critical.
But biochemically, substitution therapies are essentially managing a chronic condition, right? They occupy the mu opioid receptors just enough to stave off the withdrawal and blunt the cravings. But the fundamental dependency on an external chemical remains intact.
Exactly. You're just replacing a highly dangerous short-acting opioid with a safer long-acting one.
Right.
The baseline neurochemistry of the addictive brain, the altered receptor densities, the compromised reward pathways, all of that remains relatively static under substitution therapy. You are managing the symptoms of the altered state.
But ibogaine is doing something else.
Ibogaine, according to the clinical observations and the underground data, appears to induce a true state change. It forces a reset.
To really understand the magnitude of that reset, we have to talk about what opioid withdrawal actually does to the human nervous system.
It's brutal.
For a listener who hasn't experienced it or hasn't studied the neurobiology, it is not merely a severe flu. That's a massive misconception. It is a catastrophic systemic rebellion.
That's exactly what it is.
When a brain is continuously flooded with exogenous opioids like heroin or fentanyl, it undergoes massive neuroadaptation. It downregulates its own natural endorphin production, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it alters its receptor sensitivity just to compensate for the artificial flood of dopamine and analgesia.
Yeah, because the brain is constantly striving for homeostasis. If you artificially depress the central nervous system with opioids every day, the brain ramps up its excitatory pathways just to keep you breathing and functioning.
It's fighting back against the depressant.
Right. So when the opioid is suddenly removed, That excitatory system is left running at maximum capacity with nothing to counter it.
The brake's gone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The locus coeruleus, which is an area in the brainstem, just goes into absolute overdrive. It releases a flood of noradrenaline.
And that is what causes the agonizing physical symptoms. The violent muscle cramps, the cold sweats, the tachycardia, the relentless vomiting and diarrhea.
Yes. And layered on top of that biological chaos is a profound psychological terror. The amygdala is literally screaming that the body is dying.
Wow.
And the prefrontal cortex, the logical decision-making part of the brain, is entirely hijacked by the craving. The craving isn't just a strong desire. It's perceived by the brain as an absolute survival need, akin to a starving person needing food.
And a patient normally has to endure this biochemical torture for days, sometimes weeks. But users who undergo an Ibogaine session consistently report that as the acute 36-hour visionary phase subsides, they emerge and the withdrawal is just gone.
The physical agony is bypassed.
It's incredible.
But more importantly, the psychological craving, that relentless whispering mandate to go find the drug, is muted. Abolished in many cases, often for a period of weeks or months.
The article calls this the window of freedom.
Yes. It provides a neurochemical reprieve. A period where the biological gravity of addiction is lifted so that the individual can actually engage in the psychological and behavioral work required for long-term recovery.
So what does this all mean? Let me frame an analogy here. Standard medication-assisted treatment feels like putting a bucket under a leaky roof.
Yeah.
You are catching the water, managing the damage, keeping the house from flooding, but the hole in the roof is still very much there.
Right.
Ibogaine advocates claim the molecule actually goes up into the rafters and repairs the broken pipe. But I want to push back on this. Is it truly wiping the slate clean? Is it actually repairing the cellular damage of addiction overnight? Or is it just hitting a massive temporary pause button on the craving circuit?
This raises an important question, and it's the exact question that drove researchers to stop relying solely on patient anecdotes and start mapping the pharmacology.
Because we need to know what's actually happening to the cells.
Exactly. To determine if it's a structural repair or a temporary pause, you have to look under the hood at how this molecule interacts with the brain. And when you look at the pharmacology of Ibogaine, you do not find an elegant surgical repair tool.
No, not at all.
You find one of the most chaotic, complex mechanisms in modern neuroscience.
The article uses a fantastic term for this. It calls the neuroscience of the reset a dirty drug masterclass.
Yes.
And they are using dirty in the strict pharmacological sense, which is completely counterintuitive to how we design medicines today.
It is. In modern drug development, the ultimate goal is a clean drug.
Right.
A clean drug is a highly selective molecule designed to bind to one very specific receptor target, trigger a specific therapeutic cascade, and completely ignore the rest of the body's systems to minimize side effects.
Like, if you are developing a blood pressure medication, you want it to target the vascular system without accidentally crossing the blood-brain barrier and causing hallucinations.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the clean drug is a sniper rifle. It sits a mile away, factors in the wind, and hits one single receptor with absolute precision. Ibogaine is the total antithesis of that philosophy.
It really is.
Ibogaine sounds like a biochemical shotgun blast to the brain's entire operating system. It does not hit one target. It hits a staggering array of distinct receptor networks simultaneously. How does a shotgun blast actually result in repairing a delicate reward circuit rather than just destroying it?
To understand that, we have to look at how it creates a neurochemical symphony. Let's examine the spread of that shotgun blast, because the receptor profile is extraordinary. First, Ibogaine acts as an NMDA receptor antagonist.
Let's break that down for a second, because the NMDA receptor is crucial for learning and memory, right?
Yes, very much so.
This is the same primary mechanism of action we see in ketamine, which has revolutionized treatment-resistant depression. By blocking the NMDA receptor, specifically the binding of glutamate, you disrupt entrenched, rigid neural pathways.
Exactly. Chronic addiction creates incredibly rigid, maladaptive neural superhighways. The brain learns that the drug is the only source of reward, and those pathways literally become calcified.
So they get stuck in a rut.
Right. By acting as an NMDA antagonist, Ibogaine induces a state of rapid neuroplasticity. It essentially softens the concrete of those rigid pathways, allowing the brain a temporary window to forge new, healthier connections. It disrupts the momentum of the learned addiction.
But that's just the first pellet from the shotgun. Simultaneously, ibogaine is interacting with the opioid receptors themselves, specifically the kappa and mu opioid receptors.
This interaction is fascinating because ibogaine is not an opioid,
right?
But it has a binding affinity for these sites. Its interaction with the mu opioid receptor, which is the same receptor that heroin and fentanyl target, is really complex.
Because it doesn't get you high like heroin.
No, it doesn't agonize or activate it in the same way, which is why it doesn't cause respiratory depression or a classic opioid high. But it interacts enough to likely explain why the acute, violent physical withdrawal symptoms are mitigated so quickly. It satisfies the receptor's deficit without reinforcing the addiction loop.
Wow. And it also binds to sigma-2 receptors.
Yeah.
The article notes that while sigma-2 is still somewhat mysterious to us, it is deeply implicated in the regulation of cellular stress responses and the modulation of dopamine release.
It's a very busy molecule.
And we still aren't done. Add to that its effect on the serotonin system. It binds to the serotonin transporter, which modulates the amount of free serotonin in the synaptic cleft.
And that serotonergic interaction is almost certainly what drives the profound, visionary, mood-altering, and dreamlike state of the 36-hour experience. It severely alters perception, emotional processing, and memory retrieval.
So in one single molecule, you have a drug that is softening neural pathways via NMDA, halting physical withdrawal via opioid receptors, modulating cellular stress via sigma-2, and triggering a massive psychological processing event via serotonin. All at once.
All at once. And we haven't even touched the liver yet.
No, we haven't. And the pharmacokinetics of this drug are just as chaotic as the pharmacodynamics.
The source material highlights that when you ingest ibogaine, your liver, specifically the cytochrome P450 2D6 enzyme, goes to work on it and metabolizes it into a completely new compound called noribogaine.
Noribogaine is a crucial piece of the efficacy puzzle. Ibogaine itself is relatively fast-acting. I mean, it does its intense work over that 24 to 36-hour period and clears out.
Right.
But noribogaine is a long-lasting, highly lipophilic metabolite. It gets stored in fat tissues and slowly releases into the bloodstream.
The article refers to this as the quiet tail.
Yes, the quiet tail. Noribogaine lingers in the body for days, sometimes weeks, continuing to gently modulate those same receptor sites, particularly the serotonin and opioid transporters. So it's still working long after the trip is over.
Exactly. This long, slow release is what extends the anti-craving effects. The intense psychological storm is over, but the noribogaine provides a prolonged neurochemical buffer, stabilizing the patient during those critical first weeks of sobriety.
Okay, so we have the shotgun blast. NMDA, opioid, sigma-2, serotonin, and the long-acting noribogaine metabolite.
Right.
But the OOTW Journal article zeroes in on two specific mechanisms as the primary heavy-lifting drivers of the actual physical reset in the brain. The first involves the stimulation of something called GDNF.
Yeah. This is huge.
I want to spend some time here because this moves us from just blocking signals to actual physiological repair.
It does. GDNF stands for glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor. To understand why this is so important, you have to look at what addiction physically does to neurons.
And damages them, right?
Yeah, chronic substance abuse doesn't just change chemicals. It physically damages the microscopic structure of the brain. The neurons in the reward centers literally lose their dendritic spines, the tiny branches that allow them to communicate with other neurons. They shrivel up.
So the hardware itself is degrading.
Exactly. It's a structural breakdown. GDNF is essentially high-grade biological fertilizer for the brain. It is a protein that promotes the survival, repair, and growth of specific neuronal populations.
And ibogaine causes this.
Yes. Okay. In animal models, researchers have found that administering a single dose of ibogaine triggers a massive, highly localized expression of GDNF.
And it triggers it in a very specific zip code in the brain, right? The ventral tegmental area, or the VTA.
Right. And the VTA is the absolute ground zero for the brain's dopamine reward circuitry.
Yeah.
It is the exact region that drugs of abuse hijack to create the addiction loop.
Wow.
When ibogaine floods the VTA with GDNF, it stimulates the neurons to rapidly sprout new dendritic spines. It forces the damaged hardware to rebuild itself.
And what does that do to the behavior?
The behavioral result in animal studies is profound. Following this GDNF surge, drug self-administration drops precipitously. The hardware repair correlates directly with the cessation of the addictive behavior.
That is extraordinary. We aren't talking about masking a symptom. We are talking about inducing targeted neurogenesis in the exact circuit destroyed by the disease.
It's true healing.
And then the article introduces the second major mechanism of the reset, which might be even more fascinating from a broad pharmacological perspective. It is the blockade of the alpha-3 beta-4 nicotinic acetylcholine receptor.
Ah, yes. This specific receptor, the I34 subtype, is heavily concentrated in a pathway that acts as a sort of anti-reward or aversion center in the brain.
Okay.
For a long time, researchers didn't fully understand its role in severe addiction. But when medicinal chemists began isolating ibogaine's mechanism, they found that it acts as a potent antagonist at this specific nicotinic site. It blocks it.
And the behavioral outcome of blocking the alpha-3 beta-4 receptor is where the real paradigm shift happens, because it doesn't just reduce the intake of opioids. The data tracks a reduction in self-administration across multiple, completely structurally different classes of drugs.
That is the crucial insight. If you block that receptor in an animal model, they stop seeking opioids.
Right.
But they also stop seeking alcohol.
Yeah.
They stop seeking nicotine. They stop seeking stimulants like cocaine or methamphetamine.
Which implies something profound about the nature of addiction itself. We traditionally view these dependencies as distinct chemical problems, right?
Yeah, usually.
Like, alcohol addiction is a GABA and glutamate problem. Heroin is a mu-opioid problem. Cocaine is a dopamine transporter problem. But the fact that blocking this one single nicotinic receptor disrupts the craving for all of them suggests that underneath the specific subjective highs, there is a universal underlying neurobiological machinery of addiction.
It acts as a final common pathway for chemical dependency. By antagonizing the L3-4 receptor, ibogaine effectively jams the gears of that universal machinery.
But I have to bring us back to the reality of the shotgun blast.
Okay.
Because if we are triggering rapid neuroplasticity, modulating opioid and serotonin levels, flooding the reward center with growth factors, and jamming the universal addiction receptor all at the exact same time, how does this chaos result in healing?
It's a great question.
Like, why doesn't a systemic shock of this magnitude just trigger massive seizures, fry the nervous system, and leave the patient worse off? How does this specific symphony of chaos orchestrate a targeted reset?
That question represents the absolute edge of our current neuropharmacological understanding.
We don't really know.
Well, the prevailing theory is that the healing actually requires the synergy.
Yeah.
If you only block the NMDA receptor, you might soften the pathways, but without the GDNF, the neurons wouldn't rebuild.
Oh, I see.
And if you only block the L3-6 receptor, you might stop the craving, but the acute physical withdrawal from the opioid deficit would still completely overwhelm the patient.
So they all have to happen together.
The hypothesis is that you need the entire chaotic cascade. The softening of the rigid pathways, the muting of the physical pain, the blockade of the craving loop, and the blast of structural fertilizer all at once to overcome the immense biological gravity of severe addiction.
A sniper rifle isn't enough to stop a charging elephant. You need the shotgun.
Exactly.
And while that biochemical shotgun blast is orchestrating the physical repair on a microscopic level, it is simultaneously triggering an unignorable macro-level event. The patient is not asleep while this is happening.
Far from it.
They are wide awake, experiencing one of the most intense, grueling psychological reckonings known to humanity. This takes us to the experience itself, the waking dream.
Pharmacology classifies ibogaine as an onergen, which is quite distinct from our traditional understanding of psychedelics.
How so?
Well, if you look at the classic 5-HT2A agonist psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, DMT, the subjective experience is typically described as expansive, reality-bending, and outward-facing. The boundaries between the self and the external environment dissolve. It is a shifting of sensory perception.
Right. You see colors. You feel connected to the universe. Ibogaine is the complete inverse of that.
Entirely. Ibogaine pulls the user relentlessly inward. It doesn't usually produce open-eyed geometric fractals or external hallucinations in the way LSD does. It produces a highly structured internal cinematic experience.
It is often described as a waking dream state.
Yes.
And we cannot overstate the duration here. A classic psilocybin experience might last, what, 6 hours? The intense phase of an ibogaine experience lasts an agonizing 24 to 36 hours.
It's a marathon.
You are locked into this cinematic state for a day and a half, and the content of that cinematic state is incredibly specific. The article details how users consistently report undergoing a panoramic life review.
The brain seems to act as a relentless archivist during this phase.
Huh.
Users report that the drug surfaces vivid, emotionally dense playbacks of their most formative memories.
It just plays them back like a movie.
Yeah, it retrieves early childhood experiences, moments of profound trauma, and specifically a hyper-lucid review of the choices and actions that drove their addiction. It forces them to witness the pain they have caused themselves and their loved ones.
It sounds like being strapped to a chair in a movie theater and being forced to watch a flawless, high-definition documentary of your deepest regrets and unhealed wounds.
It can be agonizing.
But, and this connects back to the pharmacology, they aren't just reliving the trauma in a state of panic, right?
No, and that is where the magic of the neurochemical state comes into play. Because the brain is bathed in this unique cocktail, particularly the serotonin modulation and the NMDA blockade, the amygdala's typical fear response is dampened.
So they feel calm while watching it.
The user is experiencing a state of enhanced memory retrieval coupled with emotional anesthesia. They can look at the most horrifying, traumatic moments of their past from an objective, almost third-party perspective.
This sounds exactly like the mechanism of memory reconsolidation. You retrieve the traumatic memory, but because you are in a safe, chemically altered state that prevents the physiological panic, the brain rewrites the emotional valence attached to that memory before storing it back in the hard drive.
That is the exact leading psychological theory. By processing the root causes of the addiction without the unbearable emotional pain that usually accompanies them, the patient can finally integrate the trauma.
They process it.
Right. They emerge from the 36-hour marathon, exhausted, obviously, but with a felt sense that the addiction is a closed chapter. They have confronted the ghost, and the ghost has lost its power.
But let me play devil's advocate and push back on the medicalization of this specific narrative.
Sure.
Because if you take a human being, isolate them from their normal environment, and force them to undergo a grueling, terrifying, intensely emotional 36-hour psychological marathon where they confront their deepest flaws, I mean, that experience alone is going to profoundly change their perspective on life.
Without a doubt.
Whether they took Ibogaine or just went through an intense behavioral boot camp. So the critical question is, is the 36-hour life review actually curing the addiction? Or is the cure purely biological, the GDNF surge, the nicotinic receptor blockade, and the 36-hour trip is just a terrifying side effect of taking a dirty drug?
That is the million-dollar question.
Could you theoretically isolate the biological reset, skip the grueling trip, and achieve the exact same cure rate?
You have just articulated the central fault line dividing the entire field of psychedelic science right now. Are these intense, subjective psychological experiences the mechanism of healing, or are they an epiphenomenon?
Just a side effect.
Exactly. Are they just the noise the engine makes while the biological repair is happening under the hood?
The reductionist pharmaceutical model desperately wants it to be an epiphenomenon.
Of course they do. A pharmaceutical company wants a targeted, clean molecule. They want a pill a patient can take with breakfast, experience the GDNF surge and the receptor reset, and go to work without hallucinating for a day and a half.
Which makes sense from a commercial standpoint.
It does. But many clinicians and researchers who work directly with the patients argue vehemently against this. They argue that addiction is a biopsychosocial disease. Yes, the hardware is damaged and needs the GDNF repair.
But the software needs fixing, too.
Exactly. The software, the belief systems, the trauma, the lack of meaning is equally diseased. They believe the intense psychological reckoning is the necessary software update, and without it, the biological hardware reset won't hold long term.
And it is exactly that debate, fueled by the sheer undeniable efficacy of the underground reports, that has finally dragged Ibogaine out of the fringe clinics in the jungle and forced it into the brightest spotlights of mainstream scientific research.
It took a long time, but it finally happened.
Which takes us to the paradigm shift discussed in the source material, from the fringe to the forefront.
To appreciate the magnitude of this shift, you really have to remember the context. Because Ibogaine is classified as a Schedule I controlled substance in the United States, meaning the government states it has a high potential for abuse and no accepted medical use. It has been essentially impossible to secure the funding and approval to study it in rigorous modern clinical trials for decades.
But an epidemic of addiction does not wait for FDA approval processes. The opioid crisis has been ravaging communities for 20 years.
And because of that desperation, an entire massive underground industry flourished. Thousands of individuals, having exhausted every traditional medical option, just began flying to unregulated clinics in countries like Mexico, Costa Rica, and New Zealand, where the legal status is different.
And the data we had for decades was almost entirely anecdotal or observational from these clinics. The establishment largely ignored it as fringe, uncontrolled pseudoscience.
But that wall of institutional ignorance completely crumbled with the publication of the 2024 Stanford University study. When a study on an illegal hallucinogen gets published in Nature Medicine, the entire medical world stops to read it.
Oh, absolutely.
The Stanford study was a watershed moment because of its rigor and the specific population it targeted. The researchers didn't look at typical opioid use disorder. They focused on a cohort of 30 special operations military veterans.
We need to contextualize why this specific cohort is so important. Special operations forces endure extreme repetitive trauma.
Right.
We are talking about individuals suffering from severe traumatic brain injury, or TBI, often caused by repeated exposure to blast waves, combined with complex treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder.
This is arguably one of the most difficult populations in all of psychiatry to treat. Standard SSRIs, exposure therapies, even other novel interventions often fail completely because the combination of structural brain damage from the TBI and the entrenched psychological trauma of the PTSD creates this rigid, unbreakable neuroinflammatory loop.
So, because Ibogaine is Schedule 1, Stanford researchers obviously couldn't administer the drug on campus in California.
No, they had to partner with a specialized, highly monitored clinic in Mexico to actually conduct the treatment. Stanford handled all the rigorous pre- and post-treatment brain imaging, psychological evaluations, and data tracking.
And the clinical protocol was exacting, and crucially, and we will dive deeply into why this is so important shortly, the treatment was administered alongside continuous intravenous magnesium.
That magnesium part is vital.
Let's look at the results, because this is the data that forced the paradigm shift. The source material describes the outcomes for these veterans as massive and durable.
The numbers practically leap off the page of the medical journal. 1 month after a single Ibogaine treatment, the researchers reported roughly an 88% reduction in PTSD symptoms across the cohort.
Wait, an 88% reduction in treatment-resistant special operations veterans?
Yes, alongside major, statistically significant, and sustained drops in severe depression and anxiety.
That's unreal.
Furthermore, cognitive tests showed actual improvements in executive function, suggesting the neuroplasticity and the GDNF surge were actively mitigating the deficits caused by the traumatic brain injuries.
I just have to pause and let that number resonate. An 88% drop in PTSD symptoms from a single intervention. In traditional psychiatry, if a new daily pill yields a 20% to 30% improvement over placebo after 6 months of use, it is considered a blockbuster drug and generates billions of dollars.
Sure.
To achieve 88% remission in days is the kind of data anomaly that just breaks existing medical models.
It is the kind of data that demands immediate institutional action, regardless of the drug's legal history or its bizarre cultural origins.
And the institutional action was swift and unprecedented. The article highlights that in 2025, following the momentum of the Stanford data, the state of Texas, a conservative state not exactly known for championing Schedule I hallucinogens, passed legislation to fund a $50 million Ibogaine clinical trial program.
It is currently the largest government-funded Ibogaine research effort in the world, and it speaks volumes about the societal tipping point we have reached.
I am just marveling at the political reality of this. We are talking about a powerful, psychedelic African root bark championed by a 1960s heroin addict, and the Texas state government just threw $50 million of taxpayer money at it to get it through clinical trials.
It's a massive shift.
It forces the question, what was the absolute breaking point? Why did they finally stop ignoring it?
The breaking point is the intersection of two catastrophic failures in modern society. First, the staggering mortality rate of the fentanyl crisis, where traditional substitution therapies are struggling to keep pace with the sheer lethality of the synthetic opioids on the street.
Right.
Second, the escalating suicide rate among military veterans suffering from TBI and PTSD. When the accepted medical tools consistently fail to stop the dying, the political and medical tolerance for exploring radical, chaotic, and even dangerous alternatives expands dramatically.
The Stanford study proved the concept. The desperation provided the funding.
Precisely.
But, and this is the absolute most critical pivot in our deep dive today, the Stanford researchers did not just give these veterans Ibogaine and hope for the best.
No, they definitely did not.
The results are indeed staggering, but there is a very specific life or death reason they insisted on hooking every single patient up to an IV drip of magnesium during the entire experience. This brings us to the lethal footnote. Because for all its miraculous healing potential, this molecule has a dark, unforgiving side.
The source material is emphatic about this, and it must be clearly understood by anyone exploring this topic. The danger is not theoretical, and it is not a minor side effect.
It's a very real risk.
Ibogaine carries a profound cardiac risk. It has the potential to induce fatal arrhythmias. It can literally stop the human heart.
Let's unpack the exact biological mechanism of this danger. The article explains that ibogaine blocks something called the HERG potassium channel in the heart muscle. I want to break this down clearly. What exactly is a HERG channel, and why does blocking it create a lethal environment?
To understand the HERG channel, we have to look at the microscopic electrophysiology of the heartbeat. Your heart does not just squeeze autonomously. It beats in response to a highly precise, highly coordinated wave of electrical signals.
Okay.
These electrical signals are generated and propagated by the rapid movement of charged ions, specifically sodium, calcium, and potassium, flowing in and out of the heart muscle cells.
So it's essentially a biobattery charging and discharging.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When a heart cell receives the signal to contract, channels open and positive ions flood into the cell. This is called depolarization. It causes the physical squeeze of the muscle.
Got it.
But once the cell is fired, it cannot fire again until it resets its electrical baseline. It has to pump positive charge back out. It achieves this repolarization phase primarily by opening specific valves to let potassium ions flow out of the cell.
And the HERG channel is one of those potassium valves.
The HERG channel is the critical exhaust valve for potassium during the repolarization phase. When you take ibogaine, the molecule binds to the HERG channel and physically blocks it.
So the potassium cannot exit the cell efficiently. The exhaust valve is clogged.
Exactly. Because the potassium cannot flow out at the normal rate, the cell takes significantly longer to reset its electrical charge. On a standard electrocardiogram, an EKG, this electrical recovery phase is measured as the QT interval.
So by blocking the HERG channel, ibogaine causes a prolonged QT interval.
Yes. It stretches the electrical reset time. And a prolonged QT interval is a highly unstable, dangerous physiological state. The heart is essentially operating out of rhythm.
That sounds bad.
If the heart's natural pacemaker attempts to fire the next beat before the ventricular cells have fully recovered from the previous one because their QT interval has been stretched by the drug, the electrical signal fragments, it misfires.
And that misfire triggers the arrhythmia. The article names the specific dreaded arrhythmia associated with this, torsades de pointe.
Torsades de pointe. It translates from French as twisting of the points.
Hmm.
If you look at an EKG monitor when this happens, the normal rhythmic spikes of the heartbeat degenerate into a chaotic, undulating ribbon that looks like it's twisting around an axis. The heart muscle is no longer contracting in a coordinated way to pump blood. It is just quivering electrically.
And if it is just quivering, blood pressure drops to zero, the brain is deprived of oxygen, and the patient goes into cardiac arrest.
If the patient is not immediately resuscitated with a defibrillator, torsades de pointe is rapidly fatal.
And we must emphasize that the article states very clearly deaths have occurred. This is not just a warning label about a rare statistical possibility found in rat studies. Real human beings seeking to cure their infection have died taking ibogaine.
Yes. The fatalities have almost entirely occurred in unregulated settings. Imagine the typical scenario of an underground treatment. You have a patient who has been abusing heroin or fentanyl for a decade. Chronic drug abuse takes a massive toll on the cardiovascular system.
Their heart is already weak.
The patient may have undiagnosed structural heart disease. They are likely severely dehydrated and suffering from electrolyte imbalances, particularly low potassium and low magnesium, which independently prolong the QT interval.
Oh, wow.
Furthermore, they may still have residual opioids or other adulterants in their system.
So you have a highly compromised, fragile cardiovascular system, and then you introduce a massive dose of a drug known to block the HERG channel.
It is a recipe for sudden cardiac death. The drug exploits every underlying weakness in the heart's electrical system.
Which brings into sharp focus why the modern clinical trials, like the Stanford study and the New Texas Initiative, are utterly obsessed with mitigation protocols. They are not taking this risk lightly at all.
The mitigation is the only reason the trials are ethically permissible. A rigorous clinical protocol for ibogaine involves exhaustive medical-grade cardiac screening weeks before the drug is administered.
They screen everyone out who has a risk.
Any patient with a history of heart disease, baseline QT prolongation, or liver enzyme deficiencies is immediately disqualified. During the treatment itself, the patient is attached to continuous 12-lead EKG monitoring for the entire 36 to 48-hour duration, supervised by advanced cardiac life support personnel.
And then there is the magnesium protocol we mentioned earlier. Why does Stanford insist on intravenous magnesium alongside the ibogaine?
What's fascinating here is that magnesium acts as a physiological buffer against the specific electrical chaos ibogaine induces. Magnesium is a natural calcium channel blocker, and it plays a vital role in stabilizing the cellular membrane's electrical gradients.
Okay.
In acute cardiac care, intravenous magnesium sulfate is actually the primary first-line treatment for torsades de pointe.
Wait, really? So they are proactively administering the exact antidote to the arrhythmia at the same time they administer the drug that causes it?
Yes. By saturating the system with intravenous magnesium, they effectively blunt the QT prolonging effect of the ibogaine. It provides an electrical safety net for the heart while the brain undergoes neurological reset.
I want to frame this with an analogy because the reality of this medical intervention is truly staggering. Using ibogaine to cure a lethal addiction. It is like trying to fix a deeply corrupted software glitch on your computer by initiating a massive hard drive wiping reboot. But this specific reboot sequence has a small inherent biological chance of permanently frying the motherboard.
That's a very accurate way to describe it.
My question to you is, if we know with absolute certainty that this molecule has the mechanical capacity to stop a human heart, how do medical ethicists and institutional review boards justify putting it into a clinical trial at all? In the era of do no harm, how is this permissible?
The justification relies entirely on a very grim, very pragmatic calculus of comparative risk. You have to weigh the risk of the intervention against the guaranteed mortality of the disease it is treating.
Which is high.
Severe opioid addiction, particularly in the fentanyl era, has an astronomically high mortality rate. If you have a patient who has failed standard therapies 5 times, the statistical probability that they will die of a fatal overdose in the next 12 months is terrifyingly high.
The disease itself is a death sentence.
Exactly. When compared to the near certainty of death from fentanyl, the calculated, highly mitigated risk of an EKG-monitored, magnesium-buffered ibogaine session administered by medical professionals suddenly becomes an ethically viable, even imperative option.
Wow.
The source text summarizes this perfectly. The clinical environment transforms ibogaine from a game of Russian roulette into a calculated medical risk. But it also underscores the golden rule of this drug. You never, ever take it casually, and you never take it alone.
And because that inherent cardiac risk, no matter how well mitigated in a clinic, renders ibogaine completely unviable as a mainstream take-home pharmaceutical, science is not content to just study the raw root. They want the miracle without the mortality.
They want a safer version.
Which brings us to our final section, the future and the race to engineer safer miracles.
This is where the story transitions from botanical discovery to advanced medicinal chemistry. The driving hypothesis for the next generation of addiction medicine is structural.
How so?
Researchers believe that the different effects of the ibogaine molecule, the profound neuroplasticity, and the deadly cardiac blockade are mediated by different structural components of the molecule itself.
So the theory is that the key that unlocks the GDNF Caesurge in the brain is structurally distinct from the part of the key that jams the HERG channel in the heart.
Precisely. If that hypothesis holds true, the medicinal chemists can essentially use ibogaine not as a drug, but as a blueprint. They can design experimental synthetic compounds analogs that mimic the shape of the beneficial parts of the molecule while deliberately excising the parts that cause the danger.
They want to split the atom, keep the good, cut the bad. The article mentions 2 specific engineered analogs that are leading this charge, 18-MC and tabernanthalog. Let's look at 18-MC first.
18-MC, which stands for 18-methoxycorneridine, was an early, highly promising attempt at this structural separation.
What did it do?
It was designed specifically to target and block that alpha-3 beta-4 nicotinic receptor, the universal addiction pathway we discussed earlier, without interacting with the serotonin receptors that cause the hallucinations. And crucially, without binding to the HERG channel.
Yeah.
In animal models, it successfully reduced self-administration of various drugs without the intense toxicity of ibogaine.
And then there's the more recent breakthrough, tabernanthalog, which made headlines in a major Nature paper in 2021.
Tabernanthalog represents the bleeding edge of this approach. It was explicitly engineered from the ground up to be an iboga-inspired analog.
Okay.
The researchers utilized sophisticated molecular modeling to create a non-toxic, non-hallucinogenic molecule that still aggressively promotes the structural neuroplasticity, the regrowing of the dendritic spines that we see with the natural root.
The ultimate goal here is the holy grail for modern psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry. They want a safe, clean pill. They want the profound neuroplasticity. They want the broad-spectrum anti-craving mechanism that interrupts the addiction loop, but they want to completely shed the fatal cardiac risk.
And perhaps just as significantly for the pharmaceutical business model, they want to strip away the hallucinogenic properties.
Right. They want to remove the trip.
They want to skip the grueling 36-hour psychological marathon. They want a drug that resets the biological hardware without forcing the patient to confront the software of their trauma.
The research on these analogs brilliantly showcases how studying a dangerous, chaotic, natural molecule can act as a treasure map, guiding us towards safer synthetic medicines. But I have to fundamentally challenge this reductionist approach.
Hey.
Are we just trying to invent decaffeinated coffee, but hoping it still wakes us up?
It's a good point.
We spent the first half of this deep dive exploring the Woody tradition, the panoramic life review, and the profound felt sense of meaning that patients report after confronting their demons for 36 hours. If the chemists succeed, if they strip away the terrifying, deeply spiritual, inward cinematic journey and distill it down to a safe, clean little pill you take on a Tuesday morning, will it actually cure the human being?
That is the most fiercely debated philosophical and scientific question in the entire psychedelic renaissance right now.
What are the two sides saying?
The reductionist, purely biological view argues that addiction is a physical disease of the brain circuitry. If you fix the ALK2A4 receptor and flood the VTA with GDNF, the circuit is repaired, the craving stops, and the patient is cured. The hallucination is just unnecessary friction.
But their holistic psychological view pushes back hard against that.
Extremely hard. The psychological model argues that addiction is not just a hardware malfunction. It is fundamentally a disease of meaning, of isolation, and of unresolved trauma. The biological reset provides the window, but the visionary experience, the difficult, terrifying work of looking at your own life and generating new meaning, is the actual cure. They argue that you cannot resolve a crisis of the human spirit simply by flipping a molecular switch. We truly won't know which camp is correct until these engineered analogs, like tabernanthalog, pass through massive longitudinal human trials, and we see if the sobriety actually lasts without the trip.
So as we bring this deep dive to a close, let's summarize the immense, almost unbelievable paradox of ibogaine that we've unpacked for you today. You are looking at a molecule that acts as both a profound, terrifying psychological teacher and a ruthless biological reset button.
It really is both.
It represents the absolute frontier of addiction neuroscience. By leveraging mechanisms like rapid GDNF neurogenesis and the blockade of universal addiction receptors, it offers a true interruption to the cycle of chemical dependency, moving us beyond the limitations of mere substitution therapy.
But that immense, unprecedented power is permanently and intrinsically tethered to its danger. It demands the ultimate respect and the most rigorous medical supervision possible, because its ability to disrupt the electrical rhythm of the human heart is very real and very lethal.
It is the highest stakes imaginable in medicine, a cure for the incurable, guarded by a lethal risk.
It is. And for you, the listener, I think the most vital takeaway from all of this is that knowledge and scientific advancement are most valuable when they are contextualized with humility.
Well said.
We spend billions of dollars and decades of research trying to synthesize novel drugs from scratch in sterile laboratories. Yet the story of ibogaine proves that the answers to our hardest, most devastating, most complex medical problems might already exist in nature. They have been sitting in the root bark of an African shrub for millennia. Our task is not necessarily to invent the cure, but to develop the scientific humility and the technological capability to learn how to handle nature's sheer power safely.
I love that concept. Scientific humility in the face of natural complexity. And that brings me to a final provocative thought I want to leave you, the listener, to mull over on your own. We've spent a lot of time talking about the future.
We have.
We've explored the race to engineer the perfect, safe, trip-free, cardiac-friendly analog like tabernathalog. And if science is successful in bringing that pill to market, there is absolutely no doubt that it will be a historic triumph. It will undoubtedly save millions of lives from the ravages of the opioid epidemic, and that is a miraculous outcome.
Truly miraculous.
But if we completely sanitize the process, if we separate the physiological cure, the chemical reset, from the profound, terrifying, deeply spiritual life review, that the booty honor and that underground seekers have relied upon to face their darkest traumas? Do we inadvertently lose a fundamental part of what actually heals the human soul?
That is the defining question for the next decade of neuroscience.
Something to think about as we watch this fascinating field evolve. We will see you on the next Deep Dive.